Hey, everybody, this is Brett. Welcome back to School Sucks Podcast. Today is April 27th, and on the show today, Mike Males. Mike is a sociologist, and he is the author of The Scapegoat Generation, America's War on Adolescence, written in 1996, and Framing Youth, 10 Myths About the Next Generation, written in 1999, as well as many other publications. So he joins me for about 50 minutes, and we cover a variety of topics. I will say this, you know, Mike and I probably do not see eye to eye on everything, and I think you'll know those parts, but I didn't want to turn this into an economics debate with somebody who comes from a different point of view politically. I thought this was a very productive conversation, and I was honored to have him. And I certainly appreciate his time. So I hope you enjoy this, and I definitely look forward to your feedback on this one. More stuff coming soon, including possibly some pretty exciting guests. If you're not doing so yet, like us on Facebook, School Sucks Podcast. Follow us on Twitter, School Sucks Show, and check out our YouTube channel. And you can link to all of those things at the top of the page at schoolsucksproject.com. My guest today has been, from what I've seen, one of the loudest and, in my opinion, one of the most eloquent voices in what unfortunately remains a very quiet conversation about the treatment of youth, the framing, the blaming, the bashing of youth by adults in our society, by the political culture. I've referenced his work several times on the show before, as far back as School Sucks number 79, Youth Bashing a Generation Ago and Beyond. In that show, I read his article, Bashing Youth, Media Myths About Teenagers. It was written when I was a senior in high school in 1994. Unfortunately, they did not include it in our handouts. But my guest today is the sociologist, Mike Males. Mike, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
I wanted to just start by asking you about the genesis of your work, where you began and what you see as the purpose of it.
Well, other than having been a teenager myself, I think the main thing, I was trying to think about the things that did get me interested in this particular topic. One of them, of course, was going through the school system and having a different reaction, I guess, than some other people to some of the abuses of authority that I saw there. This was Oklahoma in the 1950s and 60s. Can't entirely blame the school system because the pay here has been notoriously low for educators. But in any case, there just seemed to be a lot of unnecessary, like I said, abuses of authority that I saw. And then in the 70s and 80s, I worked directly with teenagers in Youth Conservation Corps, wilderness programs, and community programs. And a lot of this in the community programs involved working directly in homes. That is, I was in their homes every day. And I think I saw a very different perspective than psychologists or other experts who see their clients most of the time outside the home. And then I went back to graduate school in the early 1990s and started researching topics and youth topics, and found that really the statistics and research tended to support what I had seen, that younger people as a generation were much better off than adults thought they were, and that there were a lot of rampant myths about teenagers that seemed to be very difficult to refute. And so I got more interested in more advocacy work and research.
And since you've been at this, I mean, I've only been at this now for a few years. My experience working with young people goes back about a decade at this point, but I can't see it, the broad picture, I think, as well as you can. So I'm interested, are there any trends you've noticed, ebbs and flows? Is this attack on youth getting more intense in recent years?
Well, there are ebbs and flows, and there's actually been some interesting articles on that. When young people are needed for the economy or needed to serve in war, and that is large-scale wars like World War II, all of a sudden there's a discovery of youth rights, and youth are treated as more mature, and they're depicted as competent and so forth. And then when young people are not needed in the economy or only small-scale wars are going on, then young people tend to be treated as incompetent and stupid and not worthy of having rights. So there's that ebb and flow. But I think a couple of larger trends have intervened over the last 40 years that have made the attack on young people more intense. And one of those is, of course, the racial change. America's youth within the next decade will become the first demographic to be multiracial. That is, there will be no dominant race. I guess you would call it all minority. The second trend, I think, is there's been a real deterioration in behaviors among adults in terms of increased crime and drug abuse among aging baby boomers. And political establishments have a great deal of difficulty confronting problems among mainstream constituencies, and so they look for someone to displace it on. And we'll probably get into the gun violence debate a little bit later. That's certainly one of the most recent examples. So I think there's been some intensifying trends. I also think that technology, particularly the internet, has enabled young people to become more interconnected globally. That is, it's removed, almost completely removed, barriers to information and communication worldwide. And this creates a lot of anxiety among older people who, I think, not universally, but I think have more of a tendency to look at the world tribally, that it's our particular group versus other groups around the world. And I think a lot of these trends make them nervous. So I think there's a lot of reasons that we've seen the attack on young people intensify.
Yeah, you mentioned baby boomers and you mentioned technology. And on my show in the past, I've displayed such a negative attitude towards that generation that I've actually received emails of people saying, Brett, you got to lay off these poor people. And since then, you know, I've tried to be more understanding. I do recognize that the baby boomer generation became parents at a really pivotal time in history, especially when we consider the impact of this technology. And it seems like for so long in human history, the older generation, the elders, was something that was treated with a tremendous amount of reverence. And it seems just in the last generation or two, because of young people's embrace of new communication and technology, a lot of the guidance from that older generation, whether it's in the schools or whether we're talking about parents or elders generally, seems to be becoming, in the minds of young people, increasingly irrelevant.
First of all, I'm a baby boomer myself, and I don't have a lot of sympathy with my generation at this point.
Right.
I have almost none, as a matter of fact. This I will say, in terms of defense of baby boomers, we came of age during the late 50s and 1960s, and this was a time period in which there was a great deal of adult turmoil in society. Divorce, for example, was becoming very widespread. There were the introduction of pharmaceutical drugs that later became street drugs. They started out with the psychiatric industry, and they became widespread in the population. And we had a major pharmaceutical abuse, primarily barbiturates, among adults in the 50s and 60s. And there was also, of course, the Civil Rights Revolution during that period on several fronts. And so there was a great deal of turmoil, although, of course, you could ignore it all if you wanted to. You could stay out of it if you wanted to. But I think baby boomers did respond fairly well as younger people to these changes. They did adapt very well. They were in the forefront of new styles and new political thoughts. And that's why it makes it particularly difficult for me to understand what happened to them after that, or to us, I guess we should say. One of the things that happened is we got rich. Baby boomers are the richest generation that ever has been or ever will be, I think, in terms of just accumulating wealth and property. Second of all, I think that we never accepted the civil rights revolutions that we were supposedly so interested in, at least in our activist wings. The larger bulk of baby boomers remained very much racially oriented, and we did not respond to a multicultural society with encouragement, but rather with trying to retreat from it and fear it. And I think, for the most part, boomers have become a much more reactionary generation as we have aged, at least on major issues. And I don't have a lot of sympathy with us at this point. We had a lot of investment in our generation by the country in terms of education, virtually free public education, all kinds of subsidies for housing and business. All of a sudden, when we got old enough to pay taxes, started paying the bulk of taxes, we discovered we didn't want to pay taxes for the next generation. And so we've really seen a starved country from 1980 forward, primarily due to change in our politics. So, I think that's been a problem. I do think boomers have done, at least for the most part, a fairly good job of adapting to new technologies. But the problem is that we don't seem to want our kids to have the same benefits we had. And we don't seem to want our kids to have the same freedoms. We're very fearful about that. And finally, as I mentioned, we've developed a serious drug abuse problem in older ages, primarily starting around age 40. And it's led to a crime problem, which has led to an imprisonment problem. and a family chaos problem. And we've had a lot of trouble admitting and dealing and confronting that. We don't even see President Obama able to deal with that reality. And so as a result, we've displaced a lot of anger and fear and paranoia onto younger generations.
You know, I've listened to a lot of baby boomers talk, too, about how they feel that children should be treated on issues like discipline in school and spanking. And even adults or people from that generation who don't have any children of their own seem to have a very hostile attitude towards more enlightened approaches towards the treatment of children, especially in the home. And that surprises me. Well, I guess it shouldn't surprise me because one of the things that I often think about when I hear these, cries to spank more children is what kind of childhood was it was typical in the 1950s and the 1960s. It seems like society is moving in the right direction as far as the punishments and, physical or otherwise, that children have to endure. And we talk a lot about parenting on my show, and I think that it's typical that kids who are abused as children often become abusive parents. Often from what I've gathered in what seems like a subconscious effort to normalize the abuse that they suffered rather than to face it. It seems like, and I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this, that we're seeing the same phenomenon in larger society. It's either that or, you know, this new level of privilege that we are introduced to as adults seems to lure us into moving on and kind of losing empathy for our child selves, especially for this older generation that I think, as you've mentioned in some of your work, might have had more freedom as far as like, yeah, go ride your bike, go down the streets. And we didn't have as much helicopter parenting back then.
Well, we're going to have to indulge some gross generalizations here because we're talking about millions of people.
Right.
When boomers grew up, corporal punishment was widespread, both in home and in schools. I was hit repeatedly in school by authority. And that was perfectly legal. And it wasn't just in Oklahoma. It was around the country in general. And if you look at surveys back then, corporal punishment was very widespread in families. It was routine. And boomers turned out to be rotten. So it did us a hell of a lot of good, you know, to have that kind of punishment. I think what boomers, when I talk about boomer freedoms, it's not so much that parents and adult authorities in that era consciously gave us freedom. You have to remember that society was much more racially segregated, and to a lot of people that feels safer. As we can show, the 60s were actually a much more dangerous time period in reality than modern society is. But it feels safer when everybody around you has some homogeneity to them. And I don't think this is a good feeling. I don't endorse good feelings based on racial homogeneity, but that's the way it felt back then. And then when people talk about the 50s and early 60s as being kind of a idyllic era, even President Clinton alludes to that kind of thing. It wasn't real. It was simply a particular illusion that the homogeneity of the time brought. So I think there's that aspect of boomers having a nostalgia that is not founded in reality. The main reason we had freedom is because our parents were experiencing more chaos and were preoccupied with themselves. We had an explosion in divorce in the 50s and 60s. And as I mentioned, drug abuse and other serious problems among grown-up generations. I think that they were simply self-preoccupied and didn't pay as much attention to their kids. And so that gave us the illusion of freedom. And it may also have given us, growing up a sense that we really wanted much more structure, although we didn't want it for ourselves. That's the contradiction that I really have trouble getting an explanation for. We didn't want it for ourselves. Boomers have never wanted more restrictions and, discipline for ourselves, but we want to discipline the hell out of our kids. And a lot of it is to make up for our own difficulties we've had as we have aged that I've already alluded to. So I think that part of it is boomers have an illusion, and there's actually been some research on this. Daniel Offer, who's a psychiatrist, has done tremendous research on generations, and he finds that boomers in general tend to remember their childhoods. He interviewed them 40 years later, the same subjects that interviewed back in the early 60s, and he found that they generally tended to remember their childhoods as much more pleasant than they thought they were at the time. So I think there's a nostalgia that is completely unwarranted. And as I said, I don't think boomers have ever been able to deal with the racial changes in this country, the multicultural aspects of society that I see as very beneficial. I think that these are tremendous, tremendously beneficial changes. And I much more enjoy American society of today than I did back then, of this multicultural diversity and so forth. But a lot of boomers, and you really see this in political polls and surveys, and older generations as well, older than boomers, have tremendous trouble with this. It's like a tribal reaction that their tribe has been invaded, that, you know, there's just too many immigrants in this country. There's too much privilege on the part of different races. There's too many lifestyles that are getting out of hand. And I would never have predicted that we were going to turn out to be conservative as we have.
You know, when you're talking about this nostalgia for this childhood experience that might not have ever existed, do you are you familiar with the concept of age dualism?
Explain what it means.
I forget the name of the author who introduced it, but that when a person becomes an adult, they actually see their child self. When I was speaking of that loss of empathy for the child self, they see the child self as an entirely different person than their adult self.
Yeah, I can understand. I can understand that one way, not in another. I mean, if you'll pardon me kind of thinking out loud for a moment.
Sure.
I think there's part of that. The idea that when I was a teenager, I think there's two kinds of age dualism, if we can kind of multiply this. One is when I was a teenager, I was an entirely different person than I am now. And that's why I don't like teenagers today, is because I don't like the way I was back then. That's one aspect. That memory may be accurate, it may be inaccurate, and they may not be as wonderful today as they think they are. The second aspect of it is the people who say, back when I was a teenager, this would be the Mary Bray Pfeiffer type of nostalgia. We didn't do all these terrible things back then that kids do today. That is a complete delusion. I mean, speaking for herself, who knows? But speaking for generations back in the 60s acted much worse than generations today by the terms that we think of as being risky behavior. So, you know, I think there's really two different ways, and maybe more than that, of remembering or imaging teenagers based on one's own experience. And I think that the problem of using one's own experience, which I call the universal mind, the idea that the content of the universe is contained within my head, that assumes that everybody's experience was the same as mine, that what I remember was the way it actually was for everyone, that the way I imagine it now is the way it is for everyone. You know, it's a real kind of egotism that I see is very common and forms the basis for a lot of opinions about, quote, kids today, is that this idea that we know what 40 million kids are like today and we know what 30 million kids were like back then. And we really don't. I mean, it's a stupid statement on its face. Michelle Obama was recently in Chicago, and she was widely praised for her tearful speech about the shooting of a 15-year-old girl, which was a very tragic event. But during her conversation with high schoolers, she said that back when she was growing up in Chicago in the late 70s and early 80s, we didn't have this kind of violence that we have today. Complete baloney. And I mean, it takes 5 minutes to look up Chicago police reports and coroner reports to find out that actually when Michelle Obama was growing up in Chicago, was one of the most murderous times in the city's history, probably the worst since the Depression. Way more homicides today, back then, than today, both per capita and as an absolute number, including among youth. I mean, back then, people under 18 accounted for 40% of the violent crime in Chicago, and now it's down below a quarter. So complete misremembering. And you know, the idea that being the First Lady of the United States, her staff would not advise her, you know, on the very topic she was going to Chicago to talk about, which was violence. Just really surprises me and shows how powerful this nostalgia is and how much it warps our perception of what's going on today.
Mm, yeah.
Go ahead.
What I was going to ask is, speaking about your work more generally, have you looked at this problem, being a sociologist, of scapegoating youth beyond the United States? Because we're talking about maybe Gen X versus baby boomers, and I think those have some specificity to our culture. Have you looked at this problem in other cultures?
To some extent. I can't claim to be an international expert, but it's really more intense in the United States than I can find it anywhere else. And this is also something that when I have some colleagues in Australia and New Zealand and the United Kingdom and so forth, and Latin America, and they view the United States as being a particularly anti-youth culture. And they tend to worry that American attitudes, because they're so appealing to an aging society, the idea of the superiority of older generations, the moral superiority, the intellectual superiority, every kind of superiority among older generations is of course a very appealing kind of concept for older people. We like to think that we're every bit as superior as we're being told. And so they worry that the very gut level appeal of that kind of thing in societies that are themselves now beginning to undergo the racial changes that the United States has already experienced. The United Kingdom is a very, for example, is a very monoracial society. They do have, some immigrant communities, but they're not citizens the way they are in the United States. And this is happening across Western Europe. Australia, of course, and New Zealand have large Aboriginal populations. I'm sorry, I don't know if that word has become offensive or not, but let's say First Peoples populations. Mm-hmm. And so they have a little more experience with diversity. And of course, Japan is a very, I would say, monocultural society, and a lot of Western Europe remains so. So they're very slowly going through some of the same racial changes, and you're seeing these same kinds of paranoias about young people emerge, especially in connection with the idea that it is younger, darker-skinned people in these societies that are causing more and more problems. But it's nowhere near the situation we have in the United States. For example, one of the UK's top domestic ministries turned over tens of millions of pounds to local youth-run committees, that is, committees run by high school students in their communities to develop projects serving young people, and they had autonomy over how to spend the money over what projects. And it's just impossible to imagine we would ever do that in the United States. I think Canada, for example, which I guess is the country that would seem most like the United States, has not had this level of paranoia. They have not, for instance, raised the ages for various kinds of behaviors in Canada the way we have in the United States. There doesn't seem to be the level of fear about young people, although occasionally it crops up. Canada tends to remain a much more liberal society than the United States in general. And Latin America, I have not seen this kind of paranoia toward young people at all. In fact, Latin America seems to be much more integrated in terms of generations than the United States is. I think this is a product of the particular affluence of the United States and a tradition, which we can get into if you like, of finding scapegoats for social problems as a way of solving those social problems, which actually contributes to not solving them. Sure. We tend, because we have always been a much more racially diverse society, to practice the politics of scapegoating much more than other nations as a rule.
Well, yeah. I mean, the reason why I asked that question, too, about comparing what goes on in the United States to other societies and cultures around the world is, I've started to realize the danger of generalizations in this area, because there are so many accidents and wild cards of history that contribute to these situations that might be unique to the United States or other places. For example, the last time I actually mentioned your work in one of my shows was a show I did called The War on a Clockwork Orange. Mm. I'm sure you've seen the film, read the book.
Yes. By the way, Anthony Burgess's view of the author of The Clockwork Orange is very different from Kubrick who did the film? Who did the film?
Yeah, Kubrick, yeah. Yep.
Very different than Kubrick's view. But anyway, we can get into that. Yeah, Burgess was very anti-youth.
Well, what I realized was that a lot of the problems that were going on in Britain in the decade preceding the release of the book and the movie, and I guess the two were about 8 or 10 years apart, Britain was in this really sort of tumultuous and transformative period after, you know, the disastrous, even though they were on the winning side of the war, their country, their economy was destroyed, and that a lot of the older generation was faced with letting go of this empire that had been there for so long. And, you know, the youth kind of coming into their own in British society, I guess, embodied that change or that uncertainty about the future. And, the whole Clockwork Orange story is kind of prophetic, because the film itself became a character in real life, very similar to the way youth were being portrayed by the story. Like, the youth were being scapegoated and exploited. And when the film came out in 1971, I believe, the film was actually blamed for youth violence that had already existed and was already being exaggerated by the older generations in British society. So very, very different set of circumstances, but a similar outcome. So if you want to talk about scapegoats more generally, I think that fits in.
Well, in A Clockwork Orange, and I have not, the film has not been, I did not see that as an anti-youth film. It was kind of interesting. Because it was obvious that the older generations had serious problems as well. It wasn't just simply scapegoating young people. But I think it could be seen that way. First of all, Clockwork Orange was supposed to be about a futuristic society in which these things happened rather than the present. But I can see that the interpretation, and really when Burgess gave his, Anthony Burgess gave his own interpretation of what he meant by the book, he said, well, violence is something just young people do. Older people don't engage in violence at all. So we really just have to talk about this as a tactic, whether or not we want to employ this kind of mechanistic state psychological readjustment to fix young people. But Kubrick did not have that view at all, as you could pretty well tell. There was a great deal of violence in older society as well. And, you know, the fact that they had let London deteriorate to the point where it was really just kind of a nightmarish scape was very evident in the film. Mm-hmm. And it didn't come across nearly as well in the book. You know, so yes, in a way, the deterioration of the United Kingdom after, you know, of course, it had lost all of its colonies, it had suffered great damage during the war, and it was really the social decline in the UK was becoming more and more apparent by the late 60s when the book was popularized. And yes, it was very easy to get around to answering your question. It was very easy to always to scapegoat younger generations because, you know, throughout millennia, going all the way back to ancient Greece, older generations have thought younger generations were in deterioration. You know, they mm-hmm. don't the you know, the boys don't hunt and the girls don't gather as well as we did when we were growing up. And you know, and as we have seen societies become societies of change in which younger generations actually grow up in environments that are socially and technologically very different and racially very different than their elders grew up in actuality. It's not the same old stable cultures of the past where the old really did possess a great deal of the wisdom. We have seen this kind of fear, and I think Clockwork Orange is one of those to emphasize that young people are growing up in a different environment than older generations did. And whether that environment is better or worse is something you have to stand back and look at objectively. Now, the film portrayed it as worse, but actually the older generation hadn't done very well itself. So I think this has added a dimension to the fear that actually young people do experience a different society than their parents did, unlike the, you know, the stable old cultures, you know, that existed for hundreds of thousands of years. And I think that the first reaction that older people are going to have to that is fear and hostility. And I think that's a bad reaction. It's a very bad reaction. It's something that we really need to get over and for our media and politicians to stop exploiting.
Yeah, I wonder how primal some of this stuff is as well. I mean, two institutions really that I've been very critical of on my show, you know, religious ideologies and political systems, and whether they have some kind of positive utility for society or not, they've both been used for control and in very negative and destructive ways. And I often wonder if this originates in the idea that, you know, men who are in charge of the tribe or eventually the society or the country, you know, at one point are strong and they grow older and weaker and they have to watch this younger generation of younger, more capable and strong men come up. And it seems like it's very, very helpful to have tools to control them, if not physically, then legally or mentally or emotionally, to which those things have been very, very successful for a long period of time.
Well, Margaret Mead, I think, was the first to point out, one of the first. If a grandparent looks at the grandchild and sees a junior version of themselves, then they're much more comforted by generational change. They're not as threatened by it. If they see this child as really an extension of themselves, and that's the way it was for hundreds of thousands of years because social change was very slow. Mm. In a modern society where social change is rapid, then parents and especially grandparents are not going to see the children and grandchildren as being extensions of themselves, which to me is it's a neutral statement. It can be good or bad. And I think in most cases today, it's good that younger people, by every reliable information we have, are responding very well to a multicultural society and a multi-lifestyle society and so forth, where older generations are having more difficulty. So there's that problem of what Margaret Mead called, you know, the advancing pace of social change was going to make older generations feel much more insecure because their positions in society were being threatened. But there's also the age-old conflict between what you mentioned that actually the younger generation replaces older generations. Younger people, particularly older teenagers and young adults, compete with older adults economically. They compete sexually. They compete on a variety of fronts. And so older generations in particular in recent times have tried to enact some legal controls to prevent younger people from competing. One of the most interesting things I found, we did some extensive studies of what is called teenage pregnancy, which is really a joke because most of it's caused by adults. Mm-hmm. But what I found was very interesting. The objection to females under age 20 having children or getting pregnant was not an objection to that per se. It was an objection to the fact that more and more males under the age of 20 were the fathers and impregnators in these births. We didn't object so much as long as it was adult men 20 and older, or those ages older than 10 years, who were causing these. And when I first raised the statistical fact that it was actually older men, not teenage boys, that were causing most of what we call teenage pregnancy, the reaction was kind of volcanic. I was surprised. It was very visceral. It was like, we don't want to get these older men into trouble. What are you bringing this up for? What are these implications that you're giving? All I was doing was, hey, it's a statistical fact and it's important to the discussion that's going on, especially as the attitude toward, quote, teenage mothers is getting more and more hostile. We need to look at, put all the facts on the table about it. And the idea was really, I really got the idea of the tribal elders being offended by the fact that the younger men were intruding on their territory, which they had always had. Most of the time throughout history, it was older men who, were the partners or rapists or whatever of mm-hmm. younger women. And all of a sudden, these younger men were getting more and more active in this area due to economic improvements after World War II. That's when we all of a sudden discovered the, quote, social problem of teenage pregnancy. But it only involved boys and girls. It didn't involve men and girls. And that's always struck me as fascinating. In fact, the Urban Institute actually put out a report saying, oh, older men causing teenage pregnancy is not a problem. That's perfectly normal in our society. It's really these younger people having these sexual liaisons, that's the problem. I mean, they just put the tribal elder argument there in a perfect document in the late 1990s. So I do see this as two kinds of competition. One, the kind that's always occurred between older and younger generations that are replacing them. And the other is the idea that younger generations are alien to the older ones because of the pace of social change. It means younger people are growing up in a different environment than the older generations did.
There's political pressure contributing to that defensiveness as well, I would think. And, when you start talking about, we can broaden this beyond just teen pregnancy to all of these issues, whether it be drugs Yes. or violence or guns. When somebody says, wait a minute, this is a problem with adults, it seems like the political pressure is like, whoa, man, lay off the adults because they, whether we're talking about the media or the politicians, and I really just see most of the mainstream media today as parrots on the shoulders of pirates, and whether those pirates are politicians or corporations, there's a real absence of investigative journalism. So they intensify the attack that may originate politically, where politicians are saying, look, we're not going after people who are going to vote for us, so let's make this about immigrants or gays or kids, some minority that's small enough, or if it's voiceless enough, it's safe for us to attack.
Yeah, I think so. I think that, again, these things are intertwined. Mm-hmm. The threat that older generations feel and the fact that politicians and the news media and corporations and the institutional world tend to represent older generations because those are, of course, the people who have power within those institutions. So you see even President Obama, who's supposed to be a younger kind of president, or especially Bill Clinton, whose main support is from younger generations. Obama would not be president. He wouldn't even be near to being president without the support of voters under age 30, mm-hmm. who essentially overruled older voters. But still, that visceral feeling that younger people are the threat even is a big factor in the Obama administration that should, to my way of thinking, have a much more progressive view than previous presidencies, but actually does not on younger generation issues. So I think there is this, there is a political interest and a cynical political interest, which was articulated by Rahm Emanuel, who was an advisor to President Clinton and, of course, President Obama's top administrative aide in the White House. And his view was that Democrats because I'm putting this in parentheses, he didn't say this, but this is the context. Because Democrats, unlike Republicans, don't have a variety of minorities that they can attack. Republicans can attack, welfare queens, and everybody knows they're talking about African Americans. They can attack gays, they can attack immigrants, they have all these different groups that they can demonize in order to whip up their base. But the Democrats really don't have these kinds of populations to attack, because that is their base.
African-Americans,
right. Gays and so forth, and immigrants tend to be the base of the Democratic Party. So how are we going to establish a Democratic family values platform that is stern and will appeal to these conservative voters? Well, the short answer is you can't. But Rahm Emanuel said, well, let's try. What we will do is we will attack young people. We will become the party of curfews and school uniforms and drug testing students and, all these crackdowns on, quote, youth violence. And we will become the tough policing party toward the young. And that's how Democrats will establish our toughness. And, of course, remember Bill Clinton, the Sister Soldier thing, where he went after a rap musician. And, his first speech on teen pregnancy was to go to a black high school in Anacostia in Washington, a very poor area of the Capitol, to make it clear who he was talking about. This is not subtle. President Obama has blamed gun violence almost entirely on young people, despite the fact that that's factually incorrect. And they keep trying to establish themselves as tough and stern, because Democrats have a hard time and liberals have a hard time doing that. And youth are really the only population they can beat up on anymore. And so I think there's that aspect too, but I think we can't overlook that it's not 100% cynical. Some of it is lingering prejudices and fears that older generations have, that these young people are just not like us. Certainly they don't look like us. 47% of the population under age 20 is now, quote, non-white, that is Hispanic, African-American, Asian, Native, and mixed race. And it will soon be over 50% compared to about a third of older generations. So there's that visceral difference. There's the idea that technology has made young people very different. And so you see all these media articles demonizing modern technology, that if you give kids cell phones, they're just going to sext and, harass each other and bully each other with cell phones and Facebook and online communications. Overlooking the fact that it was much easier to do with a telephone 40 years ago.
Right.
If you wanted to harass and bully somebody, the telephone is a great instrument. And you had everybody's address printed in a book along with their phone number, so you could find them very easily. And there was no accountability. I think a lot of these fears are just coming together, and we need real leadership that's going to say, look, let's get a grip here. We have a younger generation that's displaying some of the best social trends that we've ever seen. Lowest rates of crime, lowest rates of other serious problems, highest rates of school achievement that we've ever seen. No thanks to us. We've put all these roadblocks in their way, but nevertheless, this is occurring. And we just don't have the leadership to do that right now.
So that might be a call to action for adults who are concerned to maybe try to become these leaders. How about, I know this is a difficult question to answer maybe, but, four or five years ago, the call to action for young people was go out and vote for Obama.
Right.
And I think most of them are probably willing to admit, or maybe not, but I would hope that sooner or later, most of them will admit that to a certain extent that backfired. What would you say is a call to action for young people towards a solution that you would like to see?
There's a couple of them, but as far as your comment about voting for Obama, yes, I think Obama's been a tremendous disappointment on youth issues. And a lot of it it's been in both policy and tone. The tone has actually been worse than Republicans. Obama has been more critical of young people, I think, in ways that are wrong than the Republicans were. But of course, many might point out the Republicans didn't have to be. They have older generations' votes sewed up already. And they don't have to take this tone, anti-youth tone, that the Democrats do nearly as often. But Obama's policies, I recognize he's done a couple of good things. He did get rid of the predatory student loan interest rates, but that was only 1/6 of the increase in student costs over the last 40 years over and above inflation. So, we really need to deal with the escalation of education costs in other areas than just interest. But he did make a small step. He has been an advocate for the AmeriCorps program, which is good for employment for young people. And he's done a few good things. But the tone of the administration, and if you look at the White House initiatives, has been relentlessly negative. Just about every social problem that the White House can possibly blame on young people, it has tried to do that. And again, we've looked at this factually, and it makes no factual sense. It's simply a political tactic that the president's employing, and that's very disappointing. So I think there's that aspect that, yeah, young people were told really very stridently back in 2008 and again in 2012 that you have to vote for Obama, and then you will see real change, and that part of that change will be generational change, you know. And it is to some extent true that Obama is clearly better for younger people at this juncture of politics than the Republicans ever would have been. The Republicans are a complete disaster in terms of policies on young people, whereas Obama is a semi-disaster, but not a total one. And, you know, I think that distinction has to be made. I'm as much a 60s radical as anybody, but I still don't see the sense in saying the two parties are exactly alike. They're certainly not, especially with this far rightward drift in this older generation advocacy that the Republicans do openly now. Social Security is fine for people over 65 now, but it's not good for younger people when they get older. We have to abolish it. The whole thing is saving taxes for older and richer people, you know, et cetera.
Well, I do see that. And I think that politics has this kind of often predatory or at the very least win-lose, where if there's a winner, there's a loser, pitting interest groups against each other, nature to it, that I don't know if that's unavoidable or not. I am interested in, since you have mentioned several places in your work how young people don't have an ally really on the Republican side or the Democrat side, and it doesn't sound like you consider either of them to be allies either. No. So I am wondering, how would you say that your political outlook has informed your work? You mentioned that you, you know, came out of the radical 60s.
I really believed, and I chalk this up to some naivete, I guess, in retrospect, although I don't think it was unjustifiable to be naive, that the 60s were going to produce a much more multiracial, integrated society. And I knew at the time, because you could see it, that there was going to be a backlash against that. As you remember, George Wallace, as you remember if you studied it, George Wallace ran for president in 1968, garnered a lot of votes. Mm-hmm. The conservative backlash was pretty strong, but it was centered mainly in older generations, not entirely. There was a lot of reason to hope that this was going to pass from the scene. I had no inkling, no imagination that boomers were going to turn out to be, in many ways, as conservative as the generations they were criticizing back in the 60s. It's just been amazing to me that occurred, and I really don't think there's any good excuse for it, other than just selfishness and greed that, you know, we got rich and we had something to defend, and so all of a sudden Republicans looked better to us. And the conservatives of both parties. I think there's that aspect of the 60s radical politics. Maybe I've just gone from prolonged immaturity to premature senility, but I have not been able to see why that change occurred. It doesn't make any sense to me, and nor have in talking to my peers have I gotten any sense out of them as to why they became so conservative as a generation. There doesn't seem to be a good explanation for it. They just don't like these changes. And well, I think we're a generation of change.
Well, I can tell you a story. I mean, I'm only 35, and, you know, I graduated from college in the year 2000, and, you know, very progressive, very liberal and idealistic, as most college graduates, you know, or often are. And I began working in a residential school, shortly after you had written Bashing Youth, where you talked about the profitability of institutionalizing youth. And, you know, it was very important to me to have this purpose of, you know, contributing to helping young people. And I encountered all of these children who were wards of the state. During that time, a lot of my idealism about the kinds of programs that I had been supporting was deflated by the treatment that I saw. You know, I hold the unfortunate memory of giving a lot of what I would call today dangerous and really even experimental drugs to children as young as 10, because that was being subsidized. And I really felt that a lot of the hope I had for political solutions to problems was definitely sullied by the realization that the most powerful people, the most connected people, we're always going to be able to use those institutions as a weapon, whether they were, you know, politicians or pharmaceutical companies, against people to accomplish whatever ends they had in mind. And I guess there is a kind of greed, there is a kind of self-interest that is terribly, terribly thoughtless and dangerous and destructive. But do you see words as I'm just from what I picked up in your work, do you see words like individualism or self-interest as necessarily dirty words?
No, not at all. I mean, and again, we're back to the theme of the Clockwork Orange. If the government is going to use coercive psychiatric treatment to reform violent individuals, what's to stop it from using it in broader sense, you know, to reform, reform, in quotes, politically objectionable individuals,
sure,
or gays or lifestyle individuals, people to whom the government objects for a wide variety of reasons. That was really, I thought, the larger implication of A Clockwork Orange, and individualism was seen as, kind of an antidote to that kind of thing. No, I really don't see individualism. In fact, I think diversity is one of the most interesting things for a society to have to deal with. No society, as far as I know, has had to deal with what the United States is the leading edge of, and that is the diversification on a presumably, we haven't achieved it, but this is the fear among older generations, I think, in particular, older whites in particular, is that we will achieve it on more egalitarian terms than any other society. Certainly the racial makeup of our electorate, which of course conservatives are making an effort to suppress, is part of that idea that we are going to be the first society that has a more egalitarian racial and lifestyle makeup than previous generations or societies have ever seen, and that's threatening to a lot of people that are now in power. So I think that the diversity of society has been seen as a major threat, and individualism is part of that diversity. In fact, it's a key part of that diversity, and it's one of the things that really galls me the most about reporting on teenagers. It's kind of a feedback loop in which older generations have these fears, and so media and interest groups have learned how to exploit those fears and to augment them. So we now see in the press almost no recognition that young people are diverse. They have both diverse individually, which is probably the primary form of diversity, and then also that there are cultural differences and so forth. And you'll see statements made like after the Steubenville rape case, a number of commentators said, well, the kids in Steubenville who participated in the rape are no different than teenagers in the rest of society. I mean, it's hate speech. I mean, that's the only thing you can say about that kind of comment. And it really reveals the difficulty of the commentator rather than making any kind of comment about younger people. So I think that the individualism is a good thing. When you say self-interest, you can't stop people from pursuing self-interest. I kind of think that a political system dedicated to promoting self-interest is fine if it promotes everybody's self-interest, but it never does.
Right.
It promotes only certain and generally the most powerful self-interests against those of the powerless. So, that's a little more difficult of a concept because, individualism, of course, is not the right to commit individual serious crimes. It doesn't go that far. So there's limits on both of these. And I think that in terms of self-interest, we've less than almost any other society have indulged self-interest far beyond, any kind of social cohesion.
Well, yeah, I mean, the reason why I asked too is as far as a concept like putting the needs of society first, politicians, people in academia, the powerful have been very good for they've been really proficient at it for like a century now of taking their own interests and reframing them as society's interests, whether we're talking about,
yes,
economic policy, foreign policy, I mean, you name it. So I found more comfort and personal security in the idea that, well, it's very important to treat other people in a peaceful, non-aggressive, non-sacrificial way, that individualism and self-interest are very important concepts. And I do push that idea on my show. So I did want to get your thoughts just based on some of the things that I had seen in your writing. And I've taken up more of your time than I said I would, so I'll let you go. Is there anything that you would like to share as far as websites or work with my audience that they can check out?
Well, just as kind of a final thought, I think that And it's kind of a dismal conclusion. I hope I'm wrong about this, but I think that we really made no progress in terms of tolerance in this society, that all we've done is displace it. What has happened is a number of groups, African-Americans, well, Jews, African-Americans, you know, gays and so forth have gotten enough power. They've acquired enough power that they can punish at least liberals and moderates for making racist or homophobic statements and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so that's what has led to this illusion of tolerance, that we're tolerant because, it's not because, you know, it's because we recognize that everybody's equal and so forth. No, it's because certain groups that used to be beaten up on have gotten the power to prevent it. And so I think that it's very important for youth rights advocates to concentrate in areas and where they can, and I would think university communities would be the place to start, in securing the vote for 16-year-olds, 16 and 17-year-olds, until young people have some power. And we can already see that in the arenas in which they do have power, which is in the entertainment industry, that generally treats young people much more civilly and much more fairly than, the quote, factual news media and politicians do, because young people have more power in the entertainment industry. So I think that's really one of the most important things. And of course, some of the groups working on that are groups like the National Youth Rights Association and the, what the acronym stands for, but American Society Free of Age Restrictions. And there's also an interesting group called Civic Youth, and I think it's just civicyouth, all one word, .org, produces a lot of some of the best factual material on participating in the process and how young people can actually gain more power through greater participation in key institutions. And they have a lot of interesting studies on that subject. And then, of course, there's our own youthfacts.org, youthfacts, all one word, .org, where we try to present information, and we're trying to upgrade this site that really debunks a lot of the statements we're seeing made. So, you know, again, it depends on what a particular person's interest is, but I think this is one of the most critical battles, is to try to combat this paranoia and fear and suppression toward younger generations and the multicultural, multiracial future that they represent, that's creating a lot of what I consider unwarranted fear.
Yeah, I think this is true with a lot of movements that are in progress right now. There is an education and communication route through, you know, producing media or you know, conversations similar to that. There is the civil disobedience route, which is certainly not for everybody. And there is the political route, which is certainly not for everybody. But there are a number of avenues through which we can pursue change. So I will make sure that all of that stuff is linked in the show notes. And maybe sometime in the future, Mike, you'd come back and we could look at this lowering the voting age idea. Yes. A little more closely.
Yes, let's do that.
All right. Well, thank you so much for your time. After sharing several examples of your work, it was great to have you on, and I wish you luck, and hopefully we'll talk again in the future.
Yes, good luck to you as well.
All right. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks.
And we now continue with bonus content preview. We've come to the last section in the AV Club called pre-shows. And pre-shows are usually 15 to 20 minute mini shows that we do prior to our live show, where we plan out what we're going to do and have a little bit of loose talk, get everything warmed up. This one was November 15th, 2012, and this was in preparation for episode 175, Logic Saves Lives, Part 7. Did Stanley Kubrick help NASA fake the moon landing? I sure hope so. If you want to join the AV Club, please go to schoolsucksproject.com/AV. It really helps me, really helps the show. Thanks. Here you go. Fallacies of omission generally leaves out necessary information or misdirects the audience away from information. Stacking the deck, are you familiar with that one?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Appeal to the lack of evidence.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
So in other words,
it's like, we don't have any video of you not beating your wife.
It's the classic. It's also the classic creationist comeback against evolution, is that absence of evidence is not evidence of absence.
Yeah. So we can as long as we're like staying on, we can use the moon landing thing as a foundation. But if you have other examples, you might find things that people in libertarian media do.
Right.
With these fallacies, or the things that we commonly deal with, like arguments from creationists or arguments from political people, they all fit into this as well. The argument from the negative. Argumentum. Oh, wait. Where's argumentum ad speculum? Specula. Is that what it's really called?
I don't know. Really?
Yep. Trying to prove something in the real world by using imaginary examples alone, or asserting that.
I remember reading about that once. Oh. You must have had it in there somewhere.
Yeah.
Well, when Harry Potter plays Quidditch.
Hmm?
No,
I don't know what that means.
Harry Potter.
I know who that is.
Okay. He plays that game on the broomstick. Is that what we're talking about? Imaginary examples? Like to prove
or hypotheticals.
Trying to prove something in the real world by using imaginary examples alone, or asserting that if hypothetically, I always forget, I got to make these bigger because I'm blind. Trying to prove something in the real world by using imaginary examples alone, or asserting that if hypothetically X occurred, Y would have been the result. Oh, my! Have you guys ever heard of JFK 2?
No.
Where it says, since we know that Oswald didn't kill Kennedy, George Bush Sr. was in the CIA, and the CIA killed Kennedy, and George Bush was in charge of it. And then George W. Bush killed JFK Jr.
How about that?
Real documentary.
A real, well, I guess it doesn't take much to make a real documentary.
Have you been to LeninMurderTruth.com?
Yeah, we should talk about Lenin Murder Truth. What's the?
If I'm not mistaken, Stephen King, the author,
yep,
killed John Lennon.
Why?
Really?
I don't know.
Did he write about it in one of his books?
The dude used to call into Free Talk Live all the time. It was hilarious because he'd talk about something completely different, and then he'd get to the end of this call and be like, "It's like on my site, LeninMurderTruth.com."
But it's a joke.
I don't know. I mean, it looks as serious as any other conspiracy theory thing.
I would figure it would look like timecube.com.
No, it looks actually like a professional website. He's selling a book even. Order now. Stephen King shot John Lennon.
That's okay. I would like to see the evidence.
Nixon, Reagan, and Stephen King linked to John Lennon's murder. New evidence revealed.
Is it showing up in just like a corner of the page?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just tiny little.
He said it looks like a professional website. He didn't say it was.
Yeah. Well, then when you click on some of the like pages, it definitely doesn't look very peculiar.
King's confession. I don't want to get sidetracked by this. Holy shit.
Government codes.
All right. So we have our fallacies of omission, secrets of the shining. So Osborne, you said you made it through about 5 minutes of the Shining Code.
Yeah. That was. Oh my God. It's so horrible.
I read the summary, the synopsis on that webpage of The Shining Code, and I couldn't even imagine trying to watch the actual film.
And my brother watched it.
Oh, it just starts crazy. It's so horrible. Like, look, you can see these two things. It makes a letter A, and so what he's saying is that there was a monumental event that occurred, and it was called the Apollo moon landing.
What? But the one part that Sam talked about, that's what I want to talk about in the show, where, I mean, he does, hold on, I can probably pull it up. We can probably be watching it in like 30 seconds.
I guarantee Kubrick was doing some weird shit with that movie, right? Because he's a weird dude.
Yeah.
And I don't understand him.
Maybe he wanted us all to think.
But I think it's kind of ridiculous to try to interpret it.
Yeah.
All right. Watch this, though. Can you?
Okay.
Yeah, okay.
Not just any rocket.
Right. This is the Apollo launch pad.
Yeah.
Oh yeah, look at that.
This is 39A, the launch pad of Apollo 11.
The dramatic pause doesn't really work when the text is already written on the screen.
The boy, Danny, symbolizes Stanley Kubrick. He is kneeling in the center of an imaginary launch pad.
Okay.
Look at Danny's sweater. There is an image of a rocket on it. Not just any rocket, a very special one.
Mm-hmm.
Danny begins to stand up. The rocket is beginning to lift off. Look at the name of the rocket on the sweater. And the name is Apollo.
It actually does say Apollo.
So then
11.
He goes to room 237, which is...
how many thousands of miles away from Earth the moon is?
237,000 away. All right, so Dale's...
My feeling is this is the clip that someone saw.
Yes.
That said, okay, now I'm going to come up with a theory about how Stanley Kubrick made this entire movie about Apollo 13.
Yeah.
Or whatever it was.
It's 11. 11 go, lands 11. On the moon, right?
Yeah, 13 so, was the movie.
Right. So then he walks to room 237, yep. which is changed from the book yep. from 217. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. Mm-hmm. And then after that, he won't talk anymore. Like mm-hmm. he's been silent.
Mm-hmm.